Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, everyone. So the U.S. Supreme Court has decided to put itself in the center of some of the most politically contentious debates of the day, and it'll all come to a head right in the middle of the presidential election. Emily Bazelon is here. She's a senior editor and Supreme Court watcher at Slate. She's also the co-host of the Slate Political Gab Fest. Hey, Emily, welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, thanks for having me.
And I am such a fan of you on that GabFest, I have to say. I was already a fan of you for your appearances on this show, but there you are funny, you say unexpected things, and you're willing to challenge the other guys when they want you to shut up. So,
I'm so glad you like it. Thank you.
I'm such a big Emily Bazelon Slate Political GabFest fan. So the docket isn't even totally set yet, and there are these three huge cases with political implications in the presidential race: the Arizona illegal immigration law, Obamacare, quote unquote, and redistricting in Texas. So the Supreme Court is always important in presidential politics. Is this year different?
It is different. I mean, court watchers going back can't remember a year with this many hugely important blockbuster political cases since maybe FDR, since, you know, the New Deal was being challenged before the Supreme Court in the middle of the Depression.
And let's go down some of these, and then I'm going to play some tape that maybe you haven't even heard of how Newt Gingrich might make the Supreme Court an issue in a different way, and that is as being elected president partly on the platform of his willingness to defy Supreme Court orders. And we have that clip. But let's start with the Arizona illegal immigration law. Remind us of what that law does and how it might actually play in the presidential campaign.
It's a complicated law. There are four parts of it that the Justice Department challenged. And the Justice Department's argument is that federal law does what's called preempting state law. In other words, Arizona went too far in trying to have its own illegal immigration policy. So one part has to do with whether the state can require the cops, when they make any stop, to try to figure out whether the person they're stopping is here illegally. Then there's a provision about how now it's a crime under state law to not have legal immigration papers. Another one making it also a crime under state law if you try to get a job if you're here illegally. And then the fourth provision allows the police to arrest without a warrant anyone the cops think has committed a crime and who might be deportable.
So these are contentious issues. The Obama administration was opposed to the court taking up the case. But politically, it could work out well for Obama?
I suppose it's possible. I mean, this is a real face-off between state and federal government. The Obama administration liked the federal appeals court ruling because the federal appeals court said, look, Arizona, you went too far. You know, it's one thing for the U.S. government to give its immigration officials and state police discretion to enforce federal law, and it's another thing to kind of up the ante by making crimes out of things that the federal government treats as civil infractions, and then, you know, allowing for arrests, particularly the provision about arrest without a warrant or just checking everybody for their papers. The feds don't do that, and so can Arizona kind of do that on its own? And if the Obama administration wins the case, then it will be a real victory for the federal government being able to be supreme in the area of immigration law, and obviously that will play well for Obama. But, you know, there's also the potential for backlash in cases like this because the people who tend to care the most tend to be people who are really in favor of strict immigration enforcement. And so for the federal government to be out there challenging Arizona's effort to do that really aggressively, that could have some political cost.
And if the Supreme Court comes on down on the wrong side of this as far as immigrant groups are concerned, it could inflame the Latino voter base, and then they could turn out in greater numbers, which presumably would be to Obama's favor. So it could play politically for him in either way. And I think the same with the Obama health reform. Lower courts have split about whether it's constitutional to have an individual mandate that requires individuals to buy health insurance if they don't get it from their employers or from the government. But people were surprised that Obama referred this right to the Supreme Court. But there's a political calculus here that says maybe he wins either way.
I think that's right. You know, he's defending his law. This is his signature achievement as president. He can't afford to let it go down. And also, looking forward, if he doesn't defend this law now and then he loses election, does he really want the Romney administration out there defending this legacy of his? And if he wins, obviously, it will give the stamp of approval to this incredibly important piece of legislation. And I think the last calculation is this law is supposed to go into effect soon. It's really complicated. And he had all these administrative agencies in the federal government saying, look, we need to know whether this is happening or not.
I didn't know Romney was going to be the nominee.
I guess I jumped the gun there, especially since you want to play some Gingrich tape. I would say that the Affordable Care Act will fare ill under Romney or Newt Gingrich, whoever the Republicans pick.
Right. And do you have a prediction as to how it will fare at the Supreme Court? Will the individual mandate, which, of course, Romney instituted in Massachusetts and which Gingrich has supported in the past but not the present as a think tanker, do you think it will be held up as constitutional?
Path for the Supreme Court is to uphold this law. In order for them to get around doing that, they have to go back into this line of cases involving federalism, involving whether the Congress has the power under the Commerce Clause to do things that, you know, go beyond the most obvious powers of Congress, but have implications for commerce between the states. I think the precedent goes in favor of upholding the law, but certainly there will be an opinion written by Justice Clarence Thomas, whether he signs it all by himself or for five justices, in which he says, no, you know, this far goes beyond Congress's power, and we really have to leave some kind of domain for the states.
Precedent, Emily, you're so old-fashioned. And again, politically, maybe Obama wins either way, because he certainly would like his policy to be held up as constitutional, and that would make him look good, and that'll come down, I guess, probably in June, right? Right in the middle of the presidential campaign. If he loses, then he gets to run against the court and rev up his base.
That's right. And, you know, traditionally it's been easier for conservatives to use the court as a stalking horse and get voters upset about it and turn out voters based on fears about the Supreme Court. But if the Affordable Care Act goes down, it's possible that this year the left would respond and Obama could harness that energy.
So let me use that segue of Obama potentially running against the Supreme Court to play these clips of how Gingrich is running against the Supreme Court. And this is such a fascinating contrast to me. Emily, we had Justice Stephen Breyer on the show earlier in the year. And as you probably know, his recent book is precisely about how the Supreme Court established legitimacy over the history of the United States. And of course, in our day, we would never think of defying the Supreme Court. We might want to, but we wouldn't think generally of questioning that a Supreme Court decision is final on something. Remember Bush versus Gore, speaking of presidential elections. Once the Supreme Court made that highly controversial ruling in December of 2010, Al Gore was out there in 5 minutes saying, I don't like this, but this is how our system works. And the most important thing is that we have a peaceful transition of power in this country. And the Supreme Court made a legitimate decision that I will abide by, even though I don't agree with it. Well, we're going to play a clip of Justice Breyer talking about this on our show, the big sweep of Supreme Court legitimacy. And then along came Newt Gingrich just practically days later on Face the Nation, saying that he would, in fact, defy the United States Supreme Court as president under some circumstances. So here's Justice Breyer first from our show earlier this year.
The founders expected some group of people would have the power to say when others in government went outside the very broad guidelines, borderlines, frontiers that the Constitution describes. I think Hamilton in Federalist Number 78, very interesting little pamphlet to read, he said that power should belong to the court. Why? Because he feared that if the president had the power to say when everything was or wasn't constitutional, he'd become a tyrant.
Look, we have precedent from Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Roosevelt in 1942, when we capture 14 German spies, says to the Attorney General, I will not honor a writ from the Supreme Court, and you tell them not to issue one. And I think the Commander-in-Chief has the power to defend this country. And the recent court decisions in which the court intervened in national security, they're taking on their shoulders defending America. They are totally unprepared to do it. It is unconstitutional, and somebody should stand up to them and say no.
Newt Gingrich on CBS Face the Nation on October 9th. Justice Breyer on our show in September. Emily Bazelon from Slate. Had you heard that Gingrich clip?
I hadn't heard the clip, but I've been reading about his stance on the judiciary and particularly in challenging the Supreme Court, and it's really out there.
And he's talking about it particularly in the context of national security. So he's talking about, like, the Guantanamo rulings and how, you know, detainees can be questioned and things like that, that he claims is outside of the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. And can you imagine a situation where he, as president, would actually defy a Supreme Court order, or do you think that's rhetoric?
I think it's rhetoric, but I think there's still something important and pretty risky here for the country, which is Gingrich backs all these kind of smaller, more technical ways of cutting back on the authority of the court. He's been talking about taking away the court's authority to hear particular cases if there's a decision the president doesn't like. And you're right, that's really out of line with our constitutional order, as Justice Breyer was just saying. And the other thing I think is so odd about this is it's as if Gingrich doesn't recognize that the court is now majority conservative. And it's kind of amazing to me that despite that reality, Republicans still see the Supreme Court as this great thing to attack in elections.
Isn't that interesting? So let's say Obama health reform goes down at the Supreme Court. You might have Obama running against the conservative Roberts Court and Gingrich running against the liberal Roberts Court.
Matter what the court actually does, because those national security decisions Gingrich is talking about, first of all, they weren't, you know, slam dunk decisions for letting any detainees go. None of that has happened. And if you look at how they've actually played out, they basically handed over a lot of authority to the lower courts in Washington, D.C., which have really, you know, decimated the idea that these detainees have a kind of right to a full and fair hearing. They're not letting anybody out. So it's really strange.
And here is Seth in Manhattan calling to defend Gingrich's position on this. Hi, Seth.
I'm not saying that moving forward is necessarily the way to go, but historically, Newt Gingrich is accurate and Stephen Breyer is not. Yes, it's true that Hamilton in Federalist 78 had that opinion, but to say blanketly, as he did in that cut, that our founding fathers expected, that's not true. Jefferson and Madison, they wrote the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. The whole move in Marbury versus Madison was a move, according to most people, for John Marshall to run circles around Jefferson because he knew Jefferson would tell the court to fly a kite. You know, the famous quote from Jackson about John Marshall has made his decision regarding the Indians, you know, now let him enforce it. Lincoln is all 100% accurate. It was not at all settled in the early years of this country that the Supreme Court would have the power they ultimately had.
And that was the point of the book. And we talked about the Jackson example when the Supreme Court had declared that a treaty that the United States government had made with the Cherokee Indians over what land they may retain was just ignored by the governor of Georgia, and President Andrew Jackson decided not to enforce the Supreme Court ruling and to side for political reasons with the governor of Georgia defying the Supreme Court. But that's not to say that that was the law at that time.
But again, just to be clear, when Breyer said in that cut, and I did hear the original interview, but the cut you just played, mm-hmm. when he said that this was the intent of the founding fathers, that is very much up for debate. It was the intent of Hamilton. It was definitely not the mm-hmm. intent of Jefferson. We know Madison was on both sides. He started with Hamilton, moved over to Jefferson. It's mm-hmm. not very clear that the original intent of the founding fathers was for the Supreme Court to
right.
have that power.
But you're not arguing that this was in the Constitution, giving the Supreme Court the final authority, despite what the debate might have been leading up to the Constitution, are you?
Am I arguing that it was or was not?
Was not in the Constitution, or just that?
It's not clear in the Constitution that the Supreme Court has that right. Again, the only place it's expressed at all is in Hamilton, in Federalist 78, which Hamilton penned. But there right. were those who thought then, and yes, there was a small handful who still think now, that the Supreme Court's job was to overlook lower courts. But the whole idea of the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, why didn't Jefferson and Madison go to the court when they were not happy about the Alien and Sedition Acts? Instead, they penned the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions because they thought that was the way to deal with it, not to go to the court.
Seth, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Emily Bazelon, are you enough of a Federalist Papers wonk to have an opinion on this, or a Constitution wonk for that matter?
Sure. I'm going to wade in by saying that Seth is right. The Constitution doesn't give the Supreme Court the power to decide what the law is. But the court took that power for itself in Marbury versus Madison, you know, more than 200 years ago. And so that very much is embedded into our constitutional framework at this point, even though it's a ruling that comes from the court itself.
Still being old-fashioned, respecting all this precedent. I want to get to the third Supreme Court case that may become an issue in the presidential race once they decide. We talked about Obama health reform and the individual mandate. We talked about the Arizona immigration law and what happens after that comes down. How about this Texas redistricting case? Of the three, that's the one our listeners are probably the least familiar with. What is the Texas redistricting case?
What you need to know about this case is that Texas has more than 4 million new people in it since the 2000 census, which means it gets four new congressional seats. And most of those new Texas residents are Hispanic. So the question is, given that you have this big new presence of Hispanics and that we have a federal law called the Voting Rights Act, which says that you have to make sure that you're not diluting the representation of minorities when you draw new congressional and state legislative districts, what are we supposed to make of this new map that Texas came up with, which gives three of the four new seats to majority Republican districts? And it's really messy procedurally what's going on with this case. The Supreme Court is going to hear an oral argument about a map that a three-judge panel in San Antonio drew after a federal court in Washington said that it suspected there might be a problem with the map that that Texas itself had drawn. And so we have these two competing maps. We have this complete mess in terms of when the Texas primaries can actually take place, given how unresolved this is. But really, this is a case about whether we still respect this ideal and the voting rights of minority representation.
Now, all the states are going through these redistricting fights, and in some places, the legislatures draw the maps. In others, the courts draw the maps. They're trying to do it with independent commissions in some places to take the politics out of this. So if the Supreme Court decides to throw out this Texas court-drawn map, does this have huge implications for how district lines are drawn all over the country?
It certainly could, because the direct thing that's at issue here is how federal courts go about drawing maps when there is a potential problem under the Voting Rights Act. And this court did what it has been told to do by previous cases. Here we go, respecting precedent again. And that's to look at the last map that had constitutional approval and looked okay under the Voting Rights Act and go to there. And where the San Antonio court came out, given that standard, was with a different map that gave three of the four seats to majority Democratic districts.
But if courts can't oversee legislative lines, and we assume that legislatures are political bodies, and not sort of, you know, nonpartisan redistricting bodies. If courts can't oversee that, then what's left of the Voting Rights Act?
That's a really good question. I mean, we already have lots of gerrymandering over these kinds of lines in this country. And basically, the one thing left is you're not allowed to gerrymander in a way that takes all the minority voters and spreads them out so that they're underrepresented. And it looks at least possible that Texas did that in this case. So if that's allowed to stand, that means it looks like states really have carte blanche to draw lines the way they want to.
We just have 2 minutes left. Two quick things. One, can you think of any other year that was a presidential election year where a particular Supreme Court ruling came down in the middle of it and changed the dynamics of the race?
Well, 1992, there was a big abortion ruling. It's called Planned Parenthood versus Casey. It was the ruling that upheld Roe versus Wade, and that made the court, you know, very much part of the election season and debate. And then I think you really have to go back to Franklin Roosevelt, who, of course, made an enormous issue of the Supreme Court that blocked some of his most important New Deal legislation.
And how about the justices themselves and how they see their role with these three huge cases in 2012? I have another clip of Breyer. We don't have time to play it. But from his interview here, where I asked him specifically about Bush versus Gore and the widespread perception that this was political. The Republicans voted for the Republican, basically, and the Democrats voted for, the ruling that would have favored the Democratic candidate. And he said, no way, never, ever are judges being partisan. They may come from different ideologies, but the Supreme Court justices, every single one that he's ever known, takes their job of independence very seriously and never, bats a partisan eyelash.
Bush versus Gore is really a stain on the Supreme Court. But what's interesting is that the court's popularity ratings dipped for a little bit, and then they came back up. So it's not as if it permanently rocked the country's faith in the court. And maybe that is why, one of the reasons why, we see the court willing to intervene in these very politically charged cases.
So this year, 2012, you don't think this presidential election context that you and I and everybody else in the political media is going to be talking about all year, you think they're going to say, okay, I'm filing this in a metal box and throwing away the key?
No, I don't think they really do that, but I think they have to have faith in themselves that they are making decisions based on legal principles rather than political ones. And then it's for us to judge whether we believe them or not.
Emily Bazelon, Supreme Court Watcher, senior editor for Slate, and one of the voices in their Slate Political Gab Fest. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up next. Some big new ideas for New York, including how about a land bridge from Manhattan to Governor's Island? You like that idea? Or maybe Brooklyn to Governor's Island. And some other things. And then we will have the latest installment of our Brian Lehrer Show Listener's Holiday Gift Guide. Today we're going to have you call in and tell us about experiences that you are giving or have given rather than things. So stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.